You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert. You want a better world? So now what? This is a basic question that has bedeviled people working for social change since time immemorial, who often find themselves arguing with their own allies over how to pursue the agenda that they share. Our next guest has devoted much of his life to helping organizers learn from each other's experience, avoid repeating each other's mistakes, and find harmony even when they don't share tactics or strategy. George Lakey is a lifelong activist, on-again, off-again academic, and author of some foundational books in the world of organizing. His first was co-authored in the early years of the civil rights movement, entitled A Manual for Direct Action. His newest, written with almost six decades more experience, is How We Win, a guide to nonviolent direct action campaigning. George Lakey, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let's situate you before we get into the book. Your political formation came through Quakerism?
Yes, Quakerism and the civil rights movement. That was extremely formative for me. Whenever Bayard Rustin, for example, who was the chief strategist for the movement, was in town, I was always at his feet, learning what I could, sitting around, grabbing a back seat in a car when people were running off to Washington or something. So I was an avid learner from my elders who knew how to do nonviolent direct action campaigning. And then getting, my first arrest was in the civil rights movement and so on. So then I got to be a trainer, actually, for Mississippi Summer, 1964. So it was a lot of mixing it up. I would say the civil rights movement was my most formative time, but I got to work in movements ever since, really.
So when you write, how do you define direct action?
I define direct action as going outside the conventional means that many societies give for change. For example, suing in the court of law or running for office. That's an important thing. And education, a lot of people rely on educational methods and hope that then the polls will convince the politicians to change course. And those are the conventional things. And so direct action is outside convention and very, very often depending on disruption. That is stopping business as usual in order to draw attention and sometimes in order to make it even impossible for the rulers to continue business as usual because their system is clogged up by people using direct action.
Importantly, although you define direct action as outside those channels and that's what you write about, you don't share the contempt many people in the direct action world have for electoralism, litigation-based strategies, those more conventional channels that you mentioned.
Well, I think they all show up anyway, so why even bother? On the other hand, when I find a young organizer, and I've known many wonderful young organizers because of my university teaching, I often point out the weaknesses, the downside of litigation and of those other methods if there happens to be an economic elite or, some kind of oligarchy in society that's really pulling the strings. And if that's the case, and now the Princeton University study of the U.S. oligarchy makes the case extremely strongly that we don't, in fact, in the United States have majority rule anymore. We have a rule by the elite. And so in that case, it comes down to contesting power against power. And there's nothing like nonviolent direct action for contesting with power because we know that that can overthrow dictatorships and we don't have a dictatorship, But if it can overthrow dictators, then it can probably overthrow the economic elite once we figure out how to use it well.
Yeah, the Princeton University study you're making reference to basically looked at legislative outcomes and how they compared to popular opinion.
That's right.
Found that the vast majority of the time when popular opinion was at odds with elite opinion, it lost in the halls of Congress.
That's right. Yes. They had to reluctantly conclude at the end, if democracy is majority rule, that's not what we have.
Fair enough. The historic example that you explore in the most depth in your work, in this book, but also especially in your book that preceded it, Viking Economics, is how the Scandinavian countries turned into social democracies. Why don't you walk us through that as kind of a touchstone for the conversation?
Sure. I mean, they're different in many ways from our country, but when I look at all the countries in the world, and I've worked on five continents because I spent a lot of years doing training, social change training in multiple countries. So as I learned more and more about countries, I found that it was the Scandinavians who have delivered on the most egalitarian, the most social justice kinds of societies, because they were able to open the space so that they could invent a different economic model from one that had ever been invented, and it's an economic model that really delivers the goods. So I always look to them, considering that a century ago they were a mess. I mean, they were in such bad shape that lots of Norwegians were coming to the U.S. and Canada and other countries. Swedes were doing the same. They were fleeing their countries because of lack of opportunity and lack of justice. And now, of course, people are emigrating as rapidly as they can to those countries. And so I'm always interested when people do a remarkable turnaround, when they're in bad shape, and then they end up being in the best shape of anybody around. And so and most writers about the Nordic countries don't bother to tell that story. They just tell a photograph of what's going on right now, but they don't tell how they got there.
Right, right. The shorthand seems to be what enlightened societies, even their elites, agree that these basic human needs should be provided for by the government. Your point is that this is a result of intense social struggle.
Intense social struggle. That's right. They had to, because they had an economic elite that thought, why bother for the benefit of the people? What matters is our own greed. And so, and they had, of course, the state. They ran the state, and so they had military and police power to back them up. So what was needed, and on the popular level, was for people to figure out how to build social movements that were strong enough to contest for power. And they chose, they were right next to Russia, you know, so they had seen the Soviet model. They had seen the armed struggle that led to that. And they thought, no, we're going to try a nonviolent approach. And so it did mean mass disruption. It meant non-cooperation to the point where the economic elite couldn't rule anymore. And the power vacuum opened up and the economic elite was out. And then the people were able to take over and create democracy and freedom.
There are several other narratives about why that was so successful in Scandinavia that don't revolve around organizing tactics. One is that the presence of the Soviet Union in close proximity had quite the disciplining effect on elites who were much more willing to embrace social democracy when the alternative was communism.
That's true. That's true. That was one factor for them. But they also had, at the same time, this is 20s and 30s, they also had the economic elite also noticed that in Germany, the economic elite was making a different choice, which was to double down by hiring Hitler to run Germany. In Italy, the same thing. The economic elite decided to give the state to Mussolini and so try the fascist solution. So that was an option the economic elite could have chosen. In fact, I was able to track down a guy who later became very famous, a guy named Quisling, who secretly negotiated with generals in the Norwegian army about, hey, let's do a coup d'etat and overthrow the Norwegian government, establish a fascist state. So because he had wealthy backers. He had backers among the economic elite who thought that would be a really dandy thing to do. So they had choices that they could make, but for a variety of reasons. I don't want to say it was only the organizing smarts of the movement, but as a movement activist, of course, I like to emphasize a brilliant strategy when they come up with one, and that they did use a brilliant strategy that was able to overcome the resistance of the 1%.
Why don't you lay out the elements of that strategy?
Yeah. One thing was to offer a vision. Because whichever way one struggles for change, whether it's armed struggle or whether it's nonviolent struggle, there's lots and lots of disruption and chaos, right? Well, a lot of middle-class people especially get very worried at the point of chaos and start yearning for law and order and let's get some regularity and things. Well, at that point, you really need to show that when we get through the chaos, on the other side lies a social order that will actually be way, way better than what we've had up until now. And, very importantly, there's a place for you in it. That is, this is not an effort to create the dictatorship of the proletariat or something like that. This is an effort to create for the common good. In fact, we're not even out to rub out the economic elite. We're not out to kill them. We're out to diminish their role in the politics of our country to the 1% that they represent instead of to this 80% that they now have. And so, that they now exert the influence for them. So, What we have is a vision of a society that actually worked far better. And that's what they offered people. And that was enormously helpful in reducing the resistance and increasing middle-class support for a movement that was basically driven by the workers, the industrial workers, and the farmers. So That was a really sensible thing they did. Another thing they did was very building of self-confidence for people was to build co-ops. Because in the economic realm, it's very easy for the 1% to say, look, we know how to run an economy. What do you know about running an economy? And it's especially to say that to working class people. I was brought up working class, blue collar. And the people, my relatives, would not feel confident to go toe-to-toe with financiers, you know, or people mm-hmm. run corporations and say, we know more about the economy than you do. However, what this one of the smart things that the Scandinavians did was build big networks of co-ops that were working more effectively, more efficiently, more productively than the capitalist enterprises that they were competing with. And lumber people who made their own sawmill and dairy farmers who created their own dairies said, look, we know more about economics than these people who are pretentiously running around telling us that we're not good. And that was a big bolster of confidence for them to be able to have the heart. And let's face it, it's hard. I mean, when they call the troops out on you and kill you, it takes a lot of heart to keep the struggle going. But they built that confidence partly through their vision and through the actualization of their vision as far as they could. Through co-ops.
So these are two organizing strategies that are frequently counterposed to one another.
Right.
That is disruptive direct action in service yes. of a coherent set of demands. And what organizers today call prefigurative organizing, building the world you want to see. But you actually see them working in synergy in this context.
Far better. Far better to work them in synergy because they meet different needs. For example, the need for self-confidence, which it's hard to feel as long as you're struggling uphill through direct action. And also the need for reassurance of people. It is a real problem in our country. I have to admit that our activism has been fairly vision averse.
Frequently, you speak to organizers in the movements you characterize as being visionless, and they'll say that they're trying to do movement politics beyond the kind of narrowly constrained NGO-run campaigns that have a vision about a specific demand and nothing else, and say, actually, that amount of specificity tends to fragment coalitions instead of build broad bases. In other words, you can get a lot more people rallied if you're Occupy Wall Street with a slogan, we are the 99%, than with
right.
a 20-point platform for financial reform and wealth redistribution.
Right. I think that has been a fair point, in multiple moments. But this is a different political moment. We seem to be moving into a period of despair, a period of feeling helpless and hopeless. So many people scatter their energy, don't really get behind anything, don't get anything done, because they're waiting for the next White House tweet or whatever, being very reactive and feeling very helpless and powerless. And so I think in our political context, we need wins. And therefore, the strategy really goes back to Saul Alinsky and before that, of get that win that people can take pride in and say, oh, well, maybe we can move something. And then let's go for something bigger and bigger and bigger. Also, in this new book.
Saul Alinsky, I'm going to do some translation for our listeners.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Formative figure in community organizing, really created the template for groups like ACORN and its successors since its dissolution several years ago. Created the Industrial Area Foundation. Also someone who's drawn a lot of criticism in radical circles for mm-hmm. proposing a type of organizing that's intrinsically limited in its scope because it's based on the narrow interests of the group of people being organized.
That's right. That's right. I remember my students. I used to teach in a place called the Martin Luther King School of Social Change. It was a school for agitators. And my students always gave Saul Alinsky a very hard time when he came to guest teach at our place. And I was joining them, of course, because I thought it was very limited. On the other hand, the point that I think he was correct in making is that if you have people who feel like they haven't won anything and cannot, for them to learn that they can win something is empowering. And we can't build, I want mass movements that will, change our society fundamentally, but we're certainly not going to get that if we feel so disempowered that we can't even get, say, Medicare for all. So we do need goals that we can struggle for. I've been challenging all over the country. Now is a great time to go for Medicare for All. But that means sitting in the CVS stores. That means widespread disruption because we're up against Big Pharma. We're up against the hospitals, the insurers. We have to occupy the city of Hartford, Connecticut. You know, we have to do civil rights movements level scale disruption in order to get Medicare for All. But if we did that and got it, you would have a galvanized American public that would say, well, if we can get that, then let's get the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And judging from really what happened in the 60s and 70s, I mean, there was this tremendous stimulus by the successes in Montgomery, Alabama, and then Birmingham and so on. Those successes stimulated right out here in California, the Cesar Chavez campaign, and then multiple campaigns by students, by elders, by Puerto Ricans. Many, many people joined the fray because winning attracts more people to want to win.
Yeah, so that is one narrative, that small mm-hmm. victories lead to larger victories. The counter narrative is that small, narrow victories can have a kind of pacifying effect and induce a kind of complacency over time. The Scandinavian countries you write about for a couple of decades now have been slowly retreating from some of the social democratic institutions that American progressives so value them for.
That's right. That's right. And the Democratic Party has been, in our context, the party whose job it has been to make the most of whatever small victories we get and to use the movements that have gotten those small victories as a kind of co-opted group to pull into the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party resisted the civil rights movement, for example, all the way through its first 10 years of a succession of victories, and then realized, uh-oh, it's not going to go away. Our job is to co-opt it. And then they went ahead and co-opted it. However, again, I'd point to this political moment. This is not a political moment like before, when each generation could figure, we'll do better than our parents. This is now a time when each generation can figure we will do worse than our parents. So no longer is it the case that small victories will pacify people. In this context, small victories can lead to larger victories that can keep us on the offensive till we do the job that really needs to be done, which is to dislodge the economic elite.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you see a synergy between things like co-op organizing and direct action, see the electoral organizing almost as counterproductive mm-hmm. or a waste of time. I mean, the argument we've heard from a lot of people in direct action movements, including people very involved in Black Lives Matter organizing, is getting the right people into office doesn't get you your agenda, but it gets you the breathing room to pursue your agenda. That under a Trump presidency, your battles are largely defensive to protect gains from past battles. And that under a Clinton presidency, there might have been room to pressure her on her left flank. Or to go back to your civil rights example, that it would be hard to imagine some of the gains made during the Johnson presidency if it was a Goldwater presidency instead.
Well, I do have a different point of view about that. I do think that staying on the offensive is actually the way to go. And I think that... I'll tell you when I learned that. I learned that in the 80s when I watched Ronald Reagan come into the presidency with the assigned job of rolling back the gains that we had made in the 60s and 70s and to start the counter-revolution. He was backed by the economic elite to do that. And, of course, the way he started his signaling about that was to fire the air traffic controllers in order to destroy their union and, you know, play with the safety of American travelers in order to make a very important point. Now we are on the offensive instead of being on the defensive, and you movements, you have to go on the defensive. Well, it was a huge mistake for the labor movement to go on the defensive. Civil rights movement went on the defensive. Women's movement went on the defensive. School reform movement went on the defensive. Every major movement. The environmentalists went on the defensive after in the 70s, really, really moving. Every major movement that went on the defensive lost ground and continues to lose ground today. Gandhi said over and over to his people, do not go on the defensive. Whatever happens, keep on the offensive. A general, a military general who might not agree with Gandhi on many points, would say, you cannot win a war by being on the defensive. You've got to get on the offensive. And, of course, folk wisdom says the best defense is an offense. And these major movements, well, in contrast to a movement that I was associated with, I'm a gay man, I was, of course, involved with the LGBT movement and got arrested in, you know, in the course of our militancy. Well, we did not go on the defensive. And we went through the 80s, that horrible AIDS period, taking the offensive constantly. ACT UP was this amazingly in your face nonviolent direct action movement. And we won. And then we set another goal, equal marriage. Yes, yes, win, win, win. And how about equality in the military? Win. And now it's bathrooms. Constantly asserting new goals instead of doing what the other movements have done, which is try to retain previous gains. Trying to retain previous gains, which is, again, what some people are doing now that Trump is in, is a big mistake. A big mistake. You do not defend Obamacare, as the Democrats tried to do. You take the offensive and go for Medicare for all. That is the way to win. And that's the passion behind my book, is that I find most Americans strategically out to lunch because they're willing to react, go on the defensive just because something looks horrible and ugly, instead of go on the offensive in order to use the opportunity we have to win.
Yeah. One of the foundational distinctions you draw in the book is between two things many people conflate. One is mobilizing. The other is organizing. You want to walk us through the distinction?
Well, mobilizing gets us out on the street for a big ta-da.
And it's gotten easier than ever in the age of social media.
Easier than ever. How about, I happened to be in San Francisco when the day after the inauguration, when there was that amazing women's march, which I think cumulatively all over the country adding up is something like 4 million people. That is awesome and would have been impossible back in the day, right, without months and maybe years of organizing. So it's very impressive that we can do that, and it feels good. And I had a great time in San Francisco in that march. And on the other hand, I knew as we were marching, it wouldn't actually pan out to have a result that we could then point to and say, look, we won. It has had some benefits, but basically we're talking about mobilizing that doesn't produce a tangible result out there in the world of policy and behavior, policy and institutional change, and therefore it's hard to sustain a sense of victory after those 4 million people go out. And indeed, the amount of despair that I run into doesn't show people, you know, who are confident that we can win. Whereas if we put that energy that is abundant, much more abundant now, lots of newbies who are willing to come out in the streets now as compared with before. Let's put that energy into campaigns, because then campaigns, which still gives the exhilaration and the excitement of being on the street or being in confrontation, because conflict itself can be empowering, also has a result which we can then point to and say, look, now we have Medicare for all, or now we have this, or we have that. And that's a much, much more satisfying. And then we can build for something better.
So organizing then is about advancing a positive agenda and a vision, but that's not all it is. It's also about building an infrastructure within the movement that endures past the protest.
Thank you for adding that. Yes. That's essential to that.
I mean, the infrastructure that I saw a lot of people plug into after the moment you described the women's marches during the inaugural week of the Trump administration was electoral campaigns, and not strictly candidate-backed campaigns. There was a tremendous mobilization across the Bay in San Francisco to pass a tax on extremely wealthy businesses to double the city's spending on homeless services. Lots of people who hadn't previously been politically active were out knocking on doors or going over to adjacent congressional districts trying to flip seats from red to blue. And it seemed like those were the things that gave them the sense of meaning that you described as necessary to avoid cynicism. So I guess this is all to return to my earlier pushback on the way you dismiss electoralism. Does it always have to entail co-optation?
So that is the game that's understood among experienced politicians within the Democratic Party. It is to watch grassroots movements and use the timing to figure out when is it time to bring them into the fold and then diminish their power. Now, a lot depends on our goals. If our goal is you know, very modest, then we can appreciate that and say, well, good. But if we happen to have the kind of goals that I have, which is, you know, a very high degree of equality and justice for Americans, then I think we're not going to be contented to be the house cat of the Democrats, but that we're really going to want to take over our country and actually have a democracy. And that's a way bigger fight. And we have to go for bigger stuff. We can't just be co-opted.
All right. Well, that's a good note to end on. George Lakey, thank you so much for coming in.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
George Lakey is a lifelong activist and on-again, off-again academic and author of some foundational books in the world of organizing. His latest is How We Win, A Guide to Nonviolent Direct Action Campaigning.